juste commencer. Bienvenue à la journée Focus. On parlera un petit peu plus de ce qu'on peut faire à 10h30 au moment du forum ouvert. Puis on parlera de comment est-ce qu'on veut utiliser les discussions d'aujourd'hui pour projeter dans l'année qui vient, puis informer notre temps d'affaires, puis établir des objectifs, puis regarder l'année prochaine où est-ce qu'on est rendu à partir des débats de la journée d'aujourd'hui. On fera ça à 10h30. Pour le moment, je voudrais juste introduire Stephen Downs, qui se passe l'introduction de plusieurs façons. On est chanceux d'avoir Stephen au Nouveau-Brunswick, particulièrement de l'autre côté de la rue, même si, juste comme je le disais ce matin, on ne voit pas souvent. On le lit souvent, on est toujours là autour de lui. Stephen est un avocat et un apôtre de la diffusion de livres de l'information, du partage des connaissances et de l'ouverture de tout ce qui est le savoir et la transmission du savoir. Et c'est aussi quelqu'un qui prêche, non seulement qui prêche, mais qui démontre ce qu'il prêche. Alors, c'est pour ça qu'on peut lire toutes ces choses, qu'on peut suivre toutes ces conférences. Et puis, on est très chanceux aujourd'hui de l'avoir. Je le remercie d'avoir pris du temps pour être venu ce matin. Et puis, Stephen comprend très bien français. Il va présenter en anglais. Et puis, les questions peuvent être très bien posées en français. Il n'y a pas de problème si il y a des difficultés, on l'aidera. Mais je vais laisser la parole à tout.
Well, hello everyone. Bonjour. I would like to speak in French, but I'm not yet comfortable enough. But maybe next time. We should do this again at some point. Yeah, let's see how it goes first. Yeah, see how it goes in English. Yeah. As you mentioned, I do make all my stuff open, and so I am recording this talk just so that you know ahead of time. There will be incriminating evidence should you say anything. Anything you say can and will be posted online. I'm told this is relaxed, so I'm going to have a seat here. What I want to cover is some of the topics that I've been talking about recently, and if you've been looking at my slides, you'll see some familiar stuff here. The overall topic that I want to talk about is learning networks. And in particular, I'll be talking about learning networks from within the context of the Web 2.0 technologies that have been coming out recently. Just before I start, though, how many of you actually read my newsletter or my website? Pretty much most of you. Okay. Not all of you. Shocking, I say shocking. How many of you have a blog? The team blog. How many of you post to the team blog? More than once. I'm always interested to see how much people live, you know, the Web 2.0 life. And it's funny, I find that a lot of advocates don't really, you know, people talk about blogging, but then they don't blog, and people talk about sharing, but then they don't share. It's sort of a funny thing. That's not the topic of this talk at all, but I just thought I'd mention that. I guess I've got about an hour, and then I forget how it works, but there's discussions and all of that after that. But I do want you to feel free to interrupt at any time, to ask questions, to make comments in either English or French, or even Spanish. I've been improving in Spanish recently. No, I'm just kidding. Maybe let's not go with the Spanish just yet.
Joanna was waiting for her chance.
Yeah. Well, if you want to ask something in Spanish, go for it. We'll see.
We'll have fun.
We'll have fun, yeah. Because I want to make it clear, I've got like my agenda and my slides here and all of that, but this talk is for all of you to gain from. And so if you want to steer the direction in any way you want, I'm happy with that. If you don't want to talk about Web 2.0 and learning networks, you want to talk about, I don't know, learning management systems, copyright, the situation overseas, law, and the legalization, never mind. You can talk about anything you want. I'd be happy to do that. So I do want you to feel comfortable to, like I say, interrupt and comment at any time. So as I say, we're gonna begin from Web 2.0, the context of Web 2.0. And Web 2.0 is, in my view, first and foremost about changing the nature of the internet from being something that where we consume, something where it's media that we subscribe to, that we read or watch, to a platform where we do things, where we create our own media, where we have our own conversations. So it's shifting the internet from a medium to a place. And so consequently, Web 2.0, properly so called, is mostly about things like content creation and publishing. And all of these things here that I have on the slide are going to be very familiar to you. At least I hope they are. If they're not, that's a subject maybe for another session. But blogs, I'm sure you're all familiar with blogs and sites like Blogger, applications like WordPress, e-portfolios, again, in the educational domain, a mechanism to allow students to create and post their own content, their own creations, to post images, sites like Flickr, to post audio, sites like Odeo, or Audio, I don't know how to pronounce that, and even tools like Audacity. Audacity, as I'm sure many of you know, is a free software that allows you to record and edit sound files, and then with an application called LAME, allows you to output them as MP3, and I use Audacity all the time in the production of my own audio files. Video, everybody's talking about video these days. YouTube and Google Video used to be separate entities, still are sort of, but I think they're sort of getting merged now, aren't they? Lots of talk about online video and the acquisition of YouTube by Google. But again, notice what these things all have in common. They all have in common the property of making it possible for people to create content online. And this especially has become the case in the area of collaborative work or collaborative writing in Web 2.0. The original application, you might say, is the Wiki. And again, you're probably all familiar with the Wiki, a site that allows people to edit previously created documents. And, there are very clear applications of wikis in education. I'm not sure if you've seen this site. I've linked to it a few times where somebody has posted the South African national curriculum online in a wiki. And then, of course, the idea is that you can go into the different subjects in the wiki and edit what you think the curriculum should look like. Now, this is not an official site or anything like that, but nonetheless, this provides a framework for access to numerous online materials. Yeah, I won't even ask it then. I do comment from time to time about, you know, pagers and cell phones and email and all of that. Don't turn them off. Leave them on. Do whatever you want. I think one of the things that I've always thought important, and I talk about this from time to time in the context of online community, because people talk about, oh, well, the lecture, it's no good, it's not Web 2.0, right? And yet, here we are doing this, right? And I'm sitting here talking, and you're sitting there listening. And what is the difference between this and the old way? And why, indeed, would I do something like this? And the way I justify this, and the way I think it is different, is that at any point in time, you can get up and leave. And it won't cost you anything. Or you can read your email, or you can listen to your cell phone. I guess talking might be a bit of a thing. Never mind. But the difference is that your participation here is completely voluntary. At least I certainly hope it is. I guess I better check that before I say that. From my point of view, it is, in any case. And I think that's an important thing. That'll come up again later on in the talk. We've got collaborative bookmarking, things like Delicious and Furl, which I don't really use a whole lot. And I think that's mostly because I had my own website before these sites existed, and that's where I did my bookmarking. I just sort of kept doing it. Online applications like Writely and Gliffy, have you guys seen these? No? Oh. Now you see, here's where if I was using my computer, I would just pop into Writely and I'd be already logged in. But because I can't use my computer because of university security, which is really silly, I'm not even sure if this is going to work. But because I detest logging in, especially on computers that are set up in a different language. Alt shift? Are you serious?
Yeah.
To what?
The English.
Does it? But the keyboard still isn't.
Oh, it's a French
keyboard. You know, I mean, we need to change the keyboard, not the computer, because in the end, but Alt 2? Nope, I just go boom.
Function.
Unbelievable.
Function.
Yeah. Control Alt Delete.
No.
I've actually, I don't know, it isn't.
No?
See, for those of you listening online, we are attempting to type an ampersand.
Yes.
What was that?
It was the alternate character.
Alternate character. And two. Okay, so the thing that looks just like shift 2 is actually alternate character. Never mind.
Yeah.
Hey, I have these kind of problems too. It's not like it's unique. Okay, sorry. I don't even know if this is right, but because I do tend to forget my. Here we go. So this is Writely, and I recently presented a paper online called. Why does it do that? Isn't that kind of weird? Called Learning Networks and Connective Knowledge. And the idea here now, I put it in Writely so that the people I presented it to on the IT forum discussion list could go in and change the text and rewrite the paper. And of course, they didn't do that, which there's a lesson in that in itself. But nonetheless, as you can see from this environment, basically this is an online word processor and you can do all the usual things, make it bold and whatever. And the key thing about Writely, again, is that multiple people can be working on the same document. I really like that. Hey, somebody promised me that when I clicked on a link that I would get Firefox, but this looks distinctly like Internet Explorer, which won't let me close. There we go. So, yes. Gliffy is a wonderful little application. And again, you might not have seen this. Again, I have to log in. This whole, solve the problem of logging in and you'll be rich for life, I tell you. But you have to solve it. That has to be your focus, as opposed to becoming rich for life, which has been the primary intent of most people who've attempted to solve it so far. See, I remembered. Yeah. Well, that's actually not a bad idea, is it? So, what Gliffy is, and I don't know why. Well, it's Internet Explorer. That's why it's taking a long time. is a way for you to create documents in an online environment. Now, why isn't that working? See, when you click this little arrow, those sidebars are supposed to just slide away and disappear, but I guess that doesn't work in Internet Explorer. Unbelievable. Just a piece of... Never mind. But I don't care. People know what I think about Internet Explorer. I mean, I'm trying to work with a document here, and I can't even get slide bars because I can't make the things collapse. There we go. So here's a document I created not too long ago in Gliffy. And the idea here is that it allows you to you just drag and drop these symbols into it, and then you can put text in that, and you can change the colors of everything, all of those sorts of things. And I think I can just delete this if there is a delete button on here, right?
Yes. Supprimer.
Yeah. Why can't you just use delete? Never mind, I'm just kidding. So this is kind of, and you can also output this this document in JPEG, or you can actually publish it right online. Publish, collaborate. I don't know what that's going to do. Oh yeah, you can send it. I did see before, I don't know where it is, a place where you can publish this straight to your blog. And again, because I'm working in an unfamiliar environment, I'm all messed up. It's funny, people don't think about this. And they just throw different systems at people all the time, right? And, but it really does matter what environment you're using, especially as things get more and more complicated. It becomes more and more important to individuals to be working in their own personal environment and not somebody else's environment. You look, just a little simple change. You change the computer and change a browser from Firefox to something that doesn't work and see how messed up I get. And it's not because I'm uniquely bad at computers or just can't adapt or anything else. It's because I'm outside my environment. No, everything that I just normally do it automatically, I always have to think about now. And it throws people right off.
And something to consider in e-learning as well.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely something to consider in e-learning. I'm going to talk a bit later in this talk about the personal learning environment, which is why I wanted to show you that diagram, which isn't there anymore, but that's okay. Because the personal learning environment, one of the intents of this is to give a student, a learner, their own personal environment that they shape according to their own preferences and what they're used to, rather than forcing them to adapt to a university-based or corporate-based or whatever-based environment. So, and then we've got SlideShare, and this is something I've just been using recently, and once again I've got to log in. SlideShare is still very much beta. You see Internet Explorer handles sizing. I just tell you, just let it go right off the edge of the screen. We don't mind. Yeah. And I think I'm logged in now. And I really like SlideShare. Are the people who are on Breeze able to see these as well, or are they just hearing my voice? Okay. I do have to share them each explicitly individually, or? This must be something by Macromedia. Well, again, probably the way to go.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to be reading.
So everything's going to be shared.
Okay. Sorry, remote people. I wasn't really ignoring you. So hopefully everybody now can see. And as you can see, I've been uploading my slideshows. I haven't uploaded everything. And as you can also see, I've been a bit inconsistent in my use of the official template. There are reasons for that. But what I really like is how easy this is to access as compared to a PowerPoint slide show normally on the Internet. Look how easily that came up. Right? And this is not, well, probably the people on Breeze now flipping through these things, they're probably getting a bit of lag. But I just clicked on the link, in seconds this was up, and you're looking at my slideshow, and you're not messing around with PowerPoint or other things. And so, once again, we have an application here that mostly allows you to create and share things. When this application becomes good, as I'm sure it will over time, I expect it to do other things. I expect it to allow people to create their slideshows in this environment, not just display them. I expect them to allow people to create them collaboratively. I expect them to allow people to share them using RSS. I've already put in that request with them. They don't have that yet. I expect them to output, to allow people to export the content from the site into other applications, for example, into PowerPoint would be a neat idea, or even better, into a format called S5. How many of you are familiar with S5? S5, oh, there's no search on this thing because it's Internet Explorer. I actually have to type Google. I haven't typed that for ages. S5, a simple standards-based slideshow system, and this is S5 in action here, and as you can see, it doesn't size properly in Internet Explorer, but it is a simple way of putting slides online. You will have to, if you use it yourself, you will have to mess around with the CSS a bit to make it work in Internet Explorer. They've designed S5 to be standards compliant, you see, and you'll have to break that. Consequently, though, the thing about S5 is that your slideshows are created completely in HTML using div and spans and things like that in order to define the different pages in the slides. And then there's a lightweight JavaScript engine that turns the pages for you. And the big weakness right now is that there aren't good authoring systems for S5 slides, so you need to mostly do it by hand still. And then, of course, you know, it doesn't really work in Internet Explorer perfectly. There are some Ruby on Rails-based authoring systems, but they aren't that portable, sadly. And so it hasn't taken off the way it could, but it seems to me, it feels to me that something like this will become more important in the presentation of multimedia content in the future. Then again, I haven't really seen it take off the way I expect it to, so I'm trying to go back to look the... Right, so I'd like to go back to my presentation, please.
if I go back, then we will lose the Internet Explorer sharing.
And the bad news.
Is this your presentation?
Yes.
Okay, so you can open it right in PowerPoint.
Okay.
So
oh, okay.
Share, so.
All right, yeah, because we're sharing everything.
Yeah.
Good, gotcha. Right, that's no problem. Okay, so I was here. How are we doing so far? Has this been useful so far? The other thing, above and beyond creating your content, that Web 2.0 about, is content syndication. I mean, there are two things that made Web 2.0 possible. The first thing is something called AJAX. Asynchronous JavaScript and XML. And basically what AJAX is a bit of JavaScript doodads that allow you to communicate with the server without reloading your web page. You guys are all toads, you're probably familiar with it. The other thing that made Web 2.0 possible is RSS. It was one of these kind of delayed reaction sorts of things, like you drop the stone in the water, wait 10 seconds, then you see the thing. RSS works, well, it works for a variety of reasons, but I would say it works mostly because it is simple. And you can see how simple it is. I guess this isn't really a good slide to show that it's simple, but it really is simple. In an item, all you need really are the title, the link, and the description. And you don't even need the description. You just have a title and a link, and actually you don't really need the link if you're just posting something, and actually if you're Dave Weiner, you don't even need a title, so everything is optional. And then the other thing about RSS is, if you want to add stuff to it, you just do it.
Right? You just, you know, you want to add copyright, just add copyright to it. You want to add language to it. You know, there's more. You want to add Dublin Core metadata in there? You just add Dublin Core metadata in there. So RSS is very flexible. It's simple, but it's extensible. You can add things to it. Now, sometimes you can break it, but mostly if you add a new element to RSS, a non-standard element, then RSS readers, if they don't recognize the element, they just ignore it. And that's the principle on which web browsers are based too, right? If they didn't know what to do with a command on a web page, they just ignored it. Now Internet Explorer crashes. No, I'm just kidding. Even the Internet Explorer ignored it. And so it's sort of like, you know, the no harm, no foul principle of web design. And we compare, I did this in Spain, and it's sort of silly. I click on a link and then it asks, do you want to go there? No, I clicked on the link because I don't want to go there. Oh, it's, okay, it's Adobe. Isn't this ridiculous? Like, who designed software like this? Right? And this, in order to read this short... you're getting a pretty good object lesson, right, in how not to design. And it's funny, because these are the major commercial software companies that do this. Now, compare the RSS data model that I've just described with this. This is the data model that Rob Coker proposes in order to support learning networks. And you've got knowledge, activity, and work, and there's more, I guess, obviously. For some reason, Adobe decided to open this up in 91% instead of a size we could read. There, I'll make it a bit bigger. Competence, it's all competence-based, right? Unit of learning and all of that. Now, I asked you, what are the odds? If you have a choice between using RSS, three elements, and more if you need them, or this, which one are you going to choose? Just off the top of your head. You know? And, yeah. And the thing is, if you went Coper's way, then you have to design your resources exactly according to his vocabulary. And you actually have to use the vocabulary the way he uses the vocabulary. He actually said that in Barcelona. And so in other words, to use that system, you have to buy into his view of the world. The thing about RSS and the way the semantic web was originally supposed to work, it hasn't worked out that way, is that it's supposed to allow for multiple ways of representing the world. Web 2.0, when it encountered that problem, created tagging. Tagging is not a controlled vocabulary. In fact, it's a very uncontrolled vocabulary. And what they're trying to get at with tagging is that different people apply different words to different concepts or to different entities. Different people, in other words, use words differently. And so tagging was a way of allowing people to create metadata free form without constraining them to a particular method or system. You look at Web 2.0 applications like Flickr, like Delicious, like the SlideShare that I just showed you, they all use tagging. Now tagging has its issues, and I've criticized tagging in the past, but tagging as compared to controlled vocabulary, tagging is much more in the spirit of Web 2.0, much more participatory, much more the user is in control of their own creation. This one? Or this one? Wrong one. You've probably seen this or something like this before. The whole concept of syndication. Somebody creates something. RSS was originally created for news items, so somebody creates a news item. In our world, it might be a learning resource or a learning object even, although I guess we're not allowed to say that anymore. A learning resource. So they create a learning resource, or a news item, or a blog post, or a photograph, or a video, or, well, whatever, a person even. And then they describe that resource in metadata. RSS. Very simple metadata. This metadata is gathered or collected by a content aggregator. This is the same thing Google is, right? Google is a content aggregator of websites. RSS aggregators, they specialize on RSS. They just gather RSS files. These aggregators gather from multiple sources and put all of that content into a common database or common index. This index is searched by a user, and the results of that index are presented to them in some sort of display. I have an RSS feed here, but it's typically it could be RSS, it could be a list of resources in HTML, it could be any format. If they see a resource that looks interesting to them in this list, then they click on a link and they retrieve the original resource from where it's originally stored, and then it's displayed on their own system. This is completely not the way learning management systems work. And it's not the way they work because the learning management system puts all of this in one single entity, and then you have to get all of your content and put it on your own server. Here, notice the content doesn't move until somebody asks for it, and then it moves each time somebody asks for it. Notice as well, it's distributed. The producer of the content hangs onto the content until it's used. The aggregator is off in their neural system, and then the person actually accessing the resources is working on a separate system. Smoke break?
After I remove the cable from your feed.
Oh, that's bothering you.
Well, it seemed like it was bothering you more.
Oh, thanks for having fun with it.
Until you fell and hit your head on the table. If you offer a smoke break, I'll take one.
You notice how cleverly I got him out of the room. Now, about Rudd, I have some stories. I've created a thing called EduRSS, which is an example of this in practice. What EduRSS does is it harvests the RSS feeds produced by 300 or so people who write in the field of educational technology. And this presentation here is what those 300 or so people who are writing in this field are doing right now. So here we have melting pot, social bookmarking, privacy, net neutrality, so on and so forth. All of this stuff being created right now, right at this moment. This is today. Well, probably today anyways. One of the things I've done with EduRSS, oh, this is not going to work, is it? No. Sometimes it works, and it's kind of neat when it does. Is I've created a thing called conversation. No, because these are too recent. And what the conversation link does is...
I'm just going to check, make sure the sharing is still working.
Oh, okay.
So we'll send out
message. Is it false working sometimes?
I don't know. Yeah.
No, we ended too. See, this is why you should never have the breeze machine being the kind of presentation.
No, nothing to do with that. It's feedback from Switzerland.
Feedback from Switzerland.
No, put this one. Okay.
C'est quoi ce pendant chez lui?
Ok. Maintenant, Claude, est-ce que tu entends quelque chose?
T'as une minute.
Ok. Ça, c'est ça. On est talking now. Justine, es-tu là, toi? Est-ce que ça fonctionne?
Okay. No, yeah. That's what I said.
Okay. says it's good.
Are we good?
Yep, we're good.
Were we always good? Yeah, okay. All right, where was I? I was right in the middle.
Do you know the part where you spoke about me?
I tagged it. Okay. Here's the EduRSS conversation, and what this does is it analyzes the links that come in and then shows the posts, the blog posts that are replies to an original post. So here we have an original post. Here we have a reply to it. Here we have another reply to it. Here we have a reply to a reply, and again another reply to a reply. So the idea here is that it extracts a conversation out of a set of distributed web posts. This is why you set up the RSS, you set up the system like this with the harvester and the aggregator. Imagine if we did not aggregate the content from the different sources. Then it wouldn't be possible to create this kind of conversation. If we had a system where we're simply getting the information from the original website and we're not dealing with some sort of aggregator, we can't do this sort of value add of comparing the sources or adding different types of metadata to that information that's been harvested. Now I'm getting a whole bunch of, okay, it's coming back to here. Now, all of this so far is, you know, it's just, you know, it's resources and metadata and flinging stuff around. But where things make a turn in education is in how we're going to use this, why we set up a network like this. And because, you know, a lot of people talk about what is a learning object, what is a learning resource, and all of that. And, of course, there have been numerous definitions. But really, on my account, and of course I'm correct, on my account, what makes something a learning resource is that it's used in the context of learning. And so the purpose of a system like this is to make learning resources available for use in that context. And so the real question becomes, how are we going to define the different contexts of learning? What are these contexts of learning? And my take is the context of learning is the context in which we are trying to do something. And we need to learn something in order to do it. Traditionally, learning has always been presented separately from everything else. I mean, even look at where we are. We're in this university that's designed almost exclusively for learning. If we actually wanted to do anything, we'd have to go somewhere else. We can't do things here. Well, we can't, but you know what I mean, right? You know, if I wanted a gas station, I wouldn't put a gas in there. But the thing is, when you set up learning and learning institutions and special places where you learn, you tend not to have the learning available where you actually need it. If I was running a gas station downtown and I needed to learn about the impact of new tax regulations on the pricing of gas, that could come up. I would need some way of having that new information, that knowledge available to me right in the workplace, which means I'm going to need some kind of content distribution system like the one that I described at the harvester. I'm not going to log into an LMS and sign up for a university course in order to learn about the new tax regulations. That makes no sense. Who would do that? Here are some examples of the types of placement of learning resources into specific contexts. In electronic performance support systems, in workplace design, in knowledge management applications, for just-in-time support for applications or even for hardware or even appliances, for the support of community practices, in multimedia. Everybody's going gaga about Second Life. Second Life this, Second Life that. If you go into Second Life, the only way you can make learning really work in Second Life is to import resources from outside Second Life into Second Life. You know, you look at these online classes or things like that in Second Life, you get a whole bunch of people in this Second Life room, and what are they doing? They're watching a video. Well, where did that video come from? It came from outside Second Life and was imported into that environment. That's the way it should work. But what we need to understand here is that the learning is happening not because of Second Life. The learning is happening because we're able to import this external content into it. So, we have aggregators. There's all kinds of aggregators. I want to point to Intuit, which is a service that did it right. Intuit, well, you can see, is a free online service providing you with access to the very best web resources for education and research. Intuit is an aggregator. It allows you to aggregate from quite a number of different sources. I forget exactly how many sources. And then it allows you to search through
130,000.
You're probably able to read. Oh, yeah, there it is right there. The database contains 113,000. What Intuit does, it does a couple of things. There's two layers of content in Intuit. One layer is reviewed. It's selected, in other words, by university professors who are partnered with this project. They pick the things and then they put them in. That is very similar to what I do with my newsletter, isn't it? Where I just pick resources, I comment on them, and then I offer them, and people say, oh yes, Stephen picked that, it must be good. Or they say, oh yes, Stephen picked that, it must be worthless. One or the other. Either way works, right? Yeah. It's only if people are indifferent that it doesn't work. And then secondly, Intuit just simply harvests from various repositories without any review at all. So you get this two layers of content in Intuit. You get the reviewed content and then the simply aggregated content. And when you do a search, you can actually search on either type. And I haven't really focused on that yet, but you can go into the advanced search, which will allow you to pick all the different types, all the different subjects, all the different fields, etc. So, and I wrote a review of this site for Innovate not too long ago. So if you, the problem is with Innovate is you have to register to read it. But if you go to Innovate and register, which you shouldn't have to, but then you can read the description of Intuit. But again, this is a harvester working in the context of learning. So we get the content in. Mm-hmm. Intuit is supposed to be open source, so the answer to that is probably yes. But I would have to check that to be sure. But yeah, I mean, you're looking, but you know, I'm sort of.
No, the reason why I asked that, let's say someone has lots of time to spare, and looking for all of them and create a program that would compare them and try to establish which of the words are more popular and end up with a list that is the most used of the semantic word used in a cookie to the category of the arbiters.
Right. No, I understand that.
Because they do use a fixed taxonomy.
I can't imagine them not sharing the fixed taxonomy. And the only reason why I'm hesitating is because I just don't think it's a useful thing. Mm-hmm. I would never use somebody else's taxonomy, really. I approach this whole subject of categorization and taxonomy completely differently from most people. On my own system, I do have categories on my own system. Let me just pop in. See, and here I put like tags, right? And so here's a tag. It's actually not a tag in the way tags are used either, but it's like a category. It's called podcasting, and it's associated with a list of resources. But look at this. Definition. And then you see podcast, and then the pipe symbol, MP3 and the pipe symbol on iPod. For me, a category is a predefined search. And I do my search system on my own site in regular expressions. So, for me, a category is a regular expression. Hence, the category podcasting is in fact the regular expression that you see there. Now, that seems to be to me to be worth sharing, in the sense that you could see what different regular expressions people were using for common concepts. But I wouldn't go to organizing that any more than that. I wouldn't create big categories and subcategories and taxonomies and hierarchies and all of that, because I just don't see it as being useful. And the reason I don't see it as being useful is that, again, in order for it to be useful, you have to buy into the ontology. You have to see the world the way the taxonomers see the world. You may remember the old Yahoos. You remember the old Yahoo search engines? I was thinking about 7 or 8 years ago. Yahoo tried this, categorization way. And they were categorizing everything, and you get these ridiculously long taxonomies, and you sort of go, how could I ever have known that this item would be, under world, animals, 5-6 elements into the taxonomy? It's still there, but I don't think anybody searches Yahoo using the taxonomy, because I don't think anybody sees the world the Yahoo way. So that's why I hesitate when you ask them, and I know why you're asking. It's just not the way I would go. And so that's why I'm taking time to respond to that.
But Emacs build doesn't quite like that, except that it has multiple overlaid taxonomies because of length and somewhat a use of regular expression. In the sense that they equate certain terms to other terms.
Sure. DMOS is more true to the semantic web, properly so called, because you can apply different schemas to it. But even so, when's the last time you used DMOS to find something? When's the last time you used it at all?
I think you didn't listen to me last year then.
There it is. It's like Yahoo, only it's open source.
Okay.
All right. But now, you go in, and, right? So.
Yeah, but when you can do both, is it so bad? Like when you can just search for the word, because sometimes you can just go there and say,
when you find a subject that you want to research, if you're in research mode or whatever, you can usually get a good scope of the field by using DMOS, but it wouldn't be the first search point necessarily.
And the other thing too, okay, it's not a question of whether it's bad, okay? There's no harm to the world caused by DMOS. Probably none, right? But the question is this kind of an index worth the resources that are put into it? Right? Anyone who's in library science knows how much work it takes to categorize things and how much background knowledge and all that you need to have. There's a huge amount of overhead to creating categorization systems like this. And so they had better have a big payoff. And I argue they don't. I argue a system based on aggregation and search based on regular expressions, works much more effectively and requires almost no overhead to maintain. And this is the thing, this is why I love EduRSS so much, and I know it's my own thing, but I love EduRSS because I don't have to do any work. It just keeps working. I have my original list of sites that I harvest from, and every once in a while I'll revise that. In fact, it's getting overdue for a revision now even. And so I do share that list, yes. And so I prune it. I prune it like one of those bonsai trees, right? Yeah. This site's no longer relevant. If you've watched Andromeda, the series Andromeda, it's like that tree of life. Anyhow, and so, and then the other thing I tweak every once in a while are the categorizations. This is one of my criticisms of tags. If you just simply use a tagging system, then that depends on some person actually having tagged the item for it to work. So if you have an item, say from 1995, that's about MP3 audio being distributed over the web by RSS, it will not have been tagged podcasting, because podcasting, and for that matter tagging, did not exist then, right? But the system that I use with the predefined searches, it would be retroactively tagged podcasting, because even though the term to describe it came after the resource, you can still associate the resource with the term by means of the regular expression. This again is, you know, the weakness of these categorization schemes, right? You know, I mean, all those resources that have been categorized now, what if a whole new branch of acupuncture and Chinese medicine develops? Like, I don't know, post-Maoist acupuncture. Could happen, right? And then all these things that are historical that would have fallen in that school, they won't be under that category. That's the thing, like, you have to keep in mind, it's not simply that we have multiple points of view of the world, it's also that these points of view are dynamic, they're constantly changing. New words, new concepts, every minute, every day come up. So any categorization system has to be flexible. It has to allow for change on a minute-by-minute basis. I know it was a little off topic, but still, I think it's important. Because so much of our time is spent with metadata, and the metadata is just... Yeah.
You were going to...
You know, we went to school for like 12 years, you know, prior to the university.
Yeah.
Let's use some of that knowledge as well.
Well, yeah, but...
Meaning, supporting their point of view, and I say that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've learned words, so let's use them.
Okay, I see what you're saying. I thought you were criticizing and saying, oh, we have all this predefined knowledge in our head. We shouldn't move that. Yeah.
We all have 12 year basics wherever, sure. Even if we pick up garbage, you know?
Yeah. That's true. And it should be the case, ought to be the case, and will be the case that each individual person can have and will have their own categorization scheme. Now, they won't build these from scratch. Who does? Right? But they will have the capacity to order and sort the world in whatever way is most comfortable to them. And if you think about it, how could that be any other way? I am the only person in the world who would want a completely separate category for Aunt Marilyn. Right? The rest of you, no, right? You don't even know who that is. But you know, she is an aunt of mine, we did stuff, she took me to Expo 67, you know. So I would have a category. And people should have that capacity, should they not? And that, and they should have a means of making that as simple and flexible as possible. And that's why I like the regular expressions. Now, people may say, well, yeah, pick regular expressions, the most difficult syntax on the planet, in order to use categories, but I pick regular expressions because the syntax is so flexible, and to actually create these categories, I would want some sort of engine on top of that that lets you easily create regular expression categories. These, by the way, are million-dollar ideas you can sell to Google, because they don't have that yet.
It's like Irving Oil, cutting the forest and putting back black schools everywhere. You're getting rid of diversity, you're getting rid of, you know, nature's
right.
Own resources, and you're creating urban black schools or whatever else for the new state.
Yeah.
And this is the difference between the two views, actually. One allows for everything that's natural, like dynamic systems that cohabit together. The other one is one view of how it should be. We need to say, person, that's the black school.
And I very deliberately in Spain when I compared Rob Coper's approach to my approach, and the Rob Coper approach is also the IMS approach, the educational standards approach and all of that. And I compared it very deliberately to architecture, where you design and build things, versus ecology or ecosystems, where things grow. And, you know, and ecology doesn't mean chaos. When you build a garden, for example, you don't just leave your backyard to do whatever you want. Well, I do, but most people don't, right? You know, you design your garden, but then at a certain point, you let your garden grow. And also, too, there's a different logic, and it's a logic that I've tried to capture. It's not in this slideshow, but I've tried to capture with the image of the palm tree and the horse. That might be in the slideshow, I forget. But the idea here is that in an ecology, the things that are in the ecology aren't intended to fit together. Now, what I mean by that is, in an architecture, like building a building, the walls need to fit the ceiling, right? The plugs need to fit into the plug sockets. All the pieces need to fit together. That's why when we had learning objects, we had the analogy of Legos. Things that fit together, or molecules, things that fit together, right? All these things that fit together. But if you look at an ecology, I have a picture of a palm tree and a horse, sort of in a jungle setting. I took it near Sunshine Coast in Australia, so it's, you know, subtropical, with palm trees and things like that. And so the palm tree's there and the horse is there. There's no fit between a palm tree and a horse. They don't fit together in some way, right? A horse wasn't designed to work with a palm tree. A palm tree wasn't designed to work with a horse. You know, arguably neither was designed at all. But even if they were, they weren't designed to fit together. And yet, there they are in the same ecology, no problem, right? It's placement of things in a similar place, as opposed to the creation of things that fit together. And that gets to the heart of the difference between the architectural approach and the ecology approach. And so, you know, the horse can be in an ecology whatever it wants. It doesn't have to be something that serves a palm tree or vice versa. The horse can move in or out of the ecology. And you know, the ecology is open-ended. There isn't a purpose or a function to it. I was going to say something else, but I lost it. Oh well, it'll come back to me. So anyhow, where this is going, first instance, is towards what they're calling web tops. What a web top is, those of you who remember the early Netscape NetCenter, these are what web tops are becoming. And what you have here is your own personal environment where different types of content have been harvested from different sources. Oh, is he not putting mine up there anymore? Oh, that's no good. He used to have mine. I guess I said something. I'm just kidding. All right. And so,
I know they just play with this on an ongoing basis, but the idea is that each one of these boxes is the result of an RSS feed.
Now,
one feed or a bunch of feeds?
Well, that's a good question. Like, I think these are mostly just one feed, right? Like, boing, boing, that's just one feed, right? This Kel2 PSP looks like one feed. The news is now public, looks like one feed. Most of these look like one feed. However, EdURSS, which you've already seen, actually does bring feeds together. And if we go back to EdURSS, if we can, I don't know if we can. Never mind. Sorry, I don't know. But EdURSS aggregates and then divides things into these topics, the very same topics that I've been talking about with the regular expression, so that you can get specialized feeds from EdURSS on certain topics, such as learning objects or syndication or podcasting or whatever. And they're not using those there.
Or Blackboard.
Or Blackboard, yes. Yes, there is a feed on Blackboard. So, but
Danny didn't even smile.
This should be thought of as like a first draft, because the net vibes that I just showed you, what you should notice about that is there's no creation happening here. It's another place where you consume stuff. And this isn't Web 2.0 yet, right? It's because, you know, it isn't about consuming stuff anymore. What we want is to go from this mechanism of the linear, slow content delivery, we make, you consume, we decide, you follow. How does that go? What's the Fox slogan? We know, you don't. To a network, and this is why I call it learning networks, to a network kind of approach where the content can be created at any point, and then it moves around in the network from point to point. So here is the picture of where these web talks are evolving to. And this is the famous future VLE picture that Scott Wilson originally created, but people have been messing around with this quite a bit since then, where instead of a web talk, and importantly, instead of a learning management system, a student's primary point of access to learning will be in what was called here the future VLE. This is now being called the personal learning environment. And the idea of the personal learning environment is that it is connected to distributed resources. It's connected to a blogging engine, like LiveJournal. It's connected to image stores, like Flickr. It's connected to to-do lists, like 43 things. And so the idea is that the data is stored in the distributed environments and is accessible through the future VLE via these different like RSS feeds or friend of a friend feeds and so on. Different types of XML, very simple XML describing the resources in question. There's been quite a bit of work done on the idea of the future learning environment, or the personal learning environment, including the creation of a logo. And
alien.
Yeah, it was never intended to be the logo. But again, this is another Scott Wilson creation. He just sort of threw it together because he needed something, and well, it was adopted. Yeah, I know, it does, doesn't it? Whoops, that's not where I wanted to go. And this has even come to... Why did it do that? I don't even... Never mind. Even come to the point where you can imagine, put your learning, personal learning environment on the stick. And so now when I'm stuck using some silly computer that isn't mine, and therefore doesn't have all of my logins and passwords and resources and all that, I just take this in, pop it in, and then run the computer off of this. Because this one isn't as big, but yeah, you can get 2 gigs or more on these things, and they're quite cheap. So I can put an entire computer operating system and all of my applications and everything I need on this, and this is my personal learning environment. Why not? That's one possibility. So I've been thinking along these lines, and this is what I built. And now that I'm not traveling anymore, I'm actually going to do more work on it so that it works better. Because it really doesn't work in the Internet Explorer, because I coded it to standards. But, and in fact, it's not even going to display properly, is it? No, of course not. You're right. Yeah, no, I put in a link and didn't answer because I didn't want to go there. All right. This is what's called, what I call anyways, the RSS writer. And the idea here is You can access your content from multiple resources. I've accessed content here from something called MyGlue. What MyGlue is a simple little application that takes multiple RSS feeds and combines them into a single feed. So here are some things that I've posted recently, including this picture. Oh, I see what's happened. Now, why is that like that? So I'm just trying to give this window more space because for some reason my content window is like one line fixed. I have no idea why. I just want to eliminate
the
toolbar. That helps. Can I get rid of more, please? All right. Okay. Yeah, I'll get rid of the personal burn. There, that'll give me enough to work with at least. So, this is content coming in. This is the web top part that we've seen so far, and with the different selections that you make here, this can be completely personalizable. It can be any kinds of content coming in, text, video, audio, whatever. In this case, I just have my own content. But that's only half the story. The other half of the story is you should be able to take this content and then begin working with it in some sort of an authoring environment. And so here we are. I'm working with it. Don't know why it didn't like that. Working with it in an authoring environment. And then I should be able to take this and filling in those things, upload it to one of those remote services, a blogging engine, Flickr, YouTube, whatever. Now, this isn't working because it used to work, and then Google bought Blogger, and now it doesn't work. It bugs me that it doesn't work, though. Let me try something.
I thought you were going to say Tolliver.
It's the user ID now that's all messed up on Google. Because what happened is I have the same user ID.
Oh, I know what I'm going to use now for when I want to hack into your system.
Yeah, go for it.
A well-known philosopher.
I have the, there we go. Yeah. See, I have one username password combination for Blogger, a different one for Google, but the same username, Downs, for Blogger and Google. And so
They didn't combine them properly.
They didn't combine them properly. So now I get so it doesn't work after all.
That's
it.
Okay.
Yes. So, but normally, this, like I said, this used to work, and the idea is that you just simply upload this content to one of your remote. I have no idea what that's going to one of your remote services. The point that I'm trying to get across here is that the personal learning application needs to support aggregation, it needs to support remixing and repurposing, and it needs to support feeding forward. And then what happens is this environment becomes one node in a network of similar nodes. You have one, all of your friends have one. You create content, you send it out, your friends pick it up in their aggregator. And the network in which this thing is embedded is your social network. So the network where you send stuff out to, that goes to your friends. Where you collect stuff from, that comes from your friends. Your friends act as aggregators, you act as an aggregator. So, in other words, we're taking these internet-wide functions and we're personalizing them. And the idea here is that instead of a hierarchical system where you have single important content sources, you're creating something much more like a mesh. And then the person works inside this mesh, and they're working their own community in their own environment. And the structure and organization of this mesh ensures that the resources that they want are, in fact, the resources that pop up. My own feeling is, to a large degree, this should almost eliminate searching. You won't need to search. Your network will know what resources you need for any task that you're doing. obviously that's an empirical proposition that needs to be tested. But what this is basically the development, the evolution of a personalized web, right? And I need to be careful about how that's characterized, because there are different ways of personalizing things, right? There's personalizing in the sense that they give you a certain framework and then you can change the text, change the color, and so on. But there's personalized in the sense that the thing actually belongs to you. It's under your control. You're choosing not simply the color of the text, but you're choosing the resources to read to, the resources to send to. You're choosing whether to use blog or live journal. You're choosing whether to use Delicious or Furl, or some piece of code of your own creation. For an identity service, you're choosing whether to use Microsoft or OpenID or Skip or any of these other ID services that are available. So, and
in that system where you aggregate content, you edit it, and then you publish it,
yep.
How does someone find your content if you do not describe it anywhere, or if it, like anybody that reads it goes or syndicates finds that stuff? But if it's not described as per a control language or any other word, somebody that doesn't know you or doesn't know that content, if it's by reading you, how do you find it?
Okay. First of all, you have described it because you created it, and the best description of some content is the content itself. You already have a good way of describing the content.
If it's textual.
Ah, even if it's video. If it's video, you do an extract on the voice to text conversion, you got a text-based resource. Right?
But that's not possible.
No, but I mean, so, I mean, the world isn't going to stay the way it is right now. But, so, I know. So, And we are actually very close to having this sort of thing. But also, too, because it is a good question, okay? But I want to turn the equation around. It's not you finding good content. It's good content finding you. How does good content find you? And it has to be content that you want, that you've specifically asked for, which is, makes it even trickier. But you create some content, you throw it out into the world. Now, by throwing it out into the world, what that means is a few people, hopefully your friends, but your associates, whatever, are now reading your content. Probably a small group, right? You know, it might even be a group this size, right? Some person in that group sees what you've done, links to it, and writes about it. Now we've got more information about this original content. We've got the original content plus a description. And they may also offer an evaluation of some sort. They might have a little thumbs up, thumbs down meter on their particular content editor. They may have a, you know, 1 to 5 rating system. Any kind of things. They may tag your content if that's what they choose to do. There's all kinds of ways other people can describe your content. But if they like your content, or if they hate your content, remember, only indifference breaks the system. If they like it or they hate it, they describe it in some way, and then they feed it forward. And now, so what's happening, right, is one of you has created some content, all of you have read it, and then one of you has read the content and now passed it on to a slightly different network, right? And so it begins to spread. And if the content, you know, the more the content spreads, as each person looks at the content, we get more information about that content. So eventually, you know, an aggregator has all kinds of information about that content, right? And it will have information created not only by the content creator, but by all the different people who have read that content. And that allows us to very precisely target that content. And it allows readers to very precisely determine whether or not they want to read that content. I know I'm not describing that as well as I could be, but that is the mechanism.
So the answer is by virtue of the community being active around that content. So you need a community that exchanges trades information on that.
by virtue of members of the network being active around that content, I really want to be careful about my use of the word community, because that brings in all kinds of connotations that I don't want to bring in. In fact, I'll touch on that near the end. So, the typical response to the whole idea of personalized content creation and distribution on the part of educational institutions has been, you can't. It's true that some institutions have adopted blogs, others have adopted wikis, but for the most part, the response of educational institutions has been to lock down access, to block the blogs and the wikis and Skype and other types of tools. Typically they say, oh, it's because of the technology, we need to support, we need to be protected against viruses, blah, 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 blah. And in my view, those are smoke screens because I've worked, with both unprotected systems like the ones I have at home and protected systems like the ones at NRC and the university. And believe me, the one that's unprotected is a lot more reliable. And you sort of wonder how this could be, but all the protection, all the layers of security that get put on the systems actually make them practically unusable. That's why I couldn't use my computer. For some reason, the university just cannot allow somebody else's computer to come onto the system. And I personally think that this has to do as much with control as it has to do with protection against bad things. And of course, I think if you actually press a computer administrator, they end up saying, well, it's pretty much one and the same thing. We protect the university from bad things by controlling the environment. But it doesn't work in your garden, and I don't think it works in the universities. So, what I want to, and this slide is kind of a summary, because I've been hitting this theme over and over and over during this particular talk. The question is, how do we look at learning? Like, from what perspective do we look at learning? And I talked about, the factory model and the ecology model. The other thing I called Rob Coper was a behaviorist, in the sense that he's looking at competencies and demonstrated achievement and all of that. And if I had to contrast my own approach, I wouldn't call myself a cognitivist. I don't think that's quite the right way to go either. But what we're trying to do is to understand and be able to promote and enable diversity. The school, the university, the educational institutions in general typically attempt to make everything the same. And I think that is the weakness in educational technology, learning management systems and things like that, where they have a cohort and everybody marches through the class at the same pace and everybody does the same thing. Look at learning design. We actually get plugged into roles. And you have to fill this role. There's no room for anything like improv. There's no room for different ways of looking at the world. And I think that, again, to come back to what we were talking about when I started, that the future of learning probably isn't in online learning at all. Not online learning in the sense of learning management systems. Not even online learning in the sense of personal learning environments. I think these are transition technologies. Even the personal learning environment is a transition technology, because the computer, this thing here we have sitting on the desk, is itself a transition technology. We wouldn't use these if we didn't have to. If we actually had convenient information access devices that worked and that didn't use Microsoft, I can say that even about Linux and stuff, which is just as bad in its own interestingly varied way. What we want, again, is to get the learning into the things that we do. When I was in Mississauga a year or two ago, I ran across a thing called the Living Arts Center. And what the Living Arts Center was a big building downtown, it was right across from City Hall in Mississauga, And basically, it was a building set up to allow anybody in the community to come in and do art stuff. And they didn't, you know, they have programs and things like that set up, and they have facilities and that, but you know, there's, you know, you're not required to do this, certainly. You're not, you don't have to use the facility. If you use the facility, you don't have to sign up for a course. But these things are simply available. The main point here is the center was set up to support people doing the sorts of things that they want to do. And then the learning is embedded into that. The learning is put there in that context that helps them better be able to do the sorts of things that they want to do. And this is the picture of online learning that I have. I looked at something like the Living Arts Center, and I asked myself, how would online learning fit in that kind of environment? And there's no way we'd take this glass blower or those ballet dancers, there's no way we'd take them out of that environment, put them in a classroom and teach them ballet dancing by lecturing or whatever, or online or whatever. We would have them in this environment, and then the resources that they needed would come from the network into this environment. And they would be resources tailored to them, for the ballet dancer, tailored to the ballet dancer's experience and level of achievement and interests and preferences and things. So, the idea here is...
Even before you get to a new concept, because I see that it's written, the concept.
Yeah.
Would you agree that sometimes you need to have learned something before you do know what you are, and then direct your future learning activities in terms of what you want to do? But what I'm getting at is, because we talked a lot sometimes about people learning on their own as basically a lifelong thing, but I believe that early on in life, you need learning people to teach people how to learn. Not necessarily teach content, which can be construed as content in some regards, but before people learn how to learn, they don't really know what they want.
Well, even after they learn, they might not necessarily know what they want. I mean, this isn't a case that particularly applies in the state of non-learnedness. But look, how do I want to put this? Suppose you have a person that doesn't know what they want. What makes you the expert in determining what they do want? I mean, what grounds do you have for saying, well, you will learn this, right? And it's easy to say, well, I know a whole lot more than they do. Okay, well, that's fair enough, but so do I, right? So why do you get to teach that person and not me?
You know, well, you get to promote options to them.
Right. And, but now,
yeah. To expose them.
See, now we're getting a little more, okay, there are different ways of exposing people to options, right? Just like there are different ways of touring the city. Like, I went to Barcelona recently, and typical to my own style, I did almost no reading ahead of time, so I just, you know, got out of the train station. Damn, you know, classic case, I don't know what I want to go see, right? Now, I'm in an environment, obviously, I've just gotten off the train. Now, there's a couple of ways you can approach this. Suppose you are the good citizens of Barcelona, and you obviously want me to have a good time in your city, or at least, you know, a non-fatal time. right? Well,
Bogota moment.
Yeah, Bogota moment. Well, and, well, what do you do? Well, here's one approach. You can kidnap me, put me on a bus, drive me around to the things that you think are important, and then put me back on the train and send me on my way. Now, that would work. First of all, it would be non-fatal, right? So I wouldn't hurt myself. Secondly, I'd see all the things that were important in the city, right? And in fact, that's how we do learning now. We kidnap our kids and put them in this institution.
Okay,
right?
If you drop my mother off in Barcelona, she won't get around like you did, because you already have a background of personal quality that
I
you're
agree.
Able to learn and stuff like that.
But, okay, let's say to your mother, Are you going to advocate that the good citizens of Barcelona kidnap your mother? Well, no. Right? Even though your mother needs it, it's still a bad plan. Right? And the reason why it's a bad plan is because the act of kidnapping causes more harm than any good that it produces.
But if she does go see a travel agent, which is a structured way of looking at learning, and gets guidance, she chose herself to go see the travel agent. If she would have gone to see another one, she would have gotten a different point of view.
That's right. So now you see we have the difference between a kidnapping and a tour. Right? She gets off the train in Barcelona. The scenario depends on no pre-planning, so that's okay, right? Because otherwise, the premise that you have somebody who doesn't know what they want doesn't apply. So they get off the train, right? Now, what you do, if you are the citizens of Barcelona, is you make available, in a visible manner, some options. One option is to take a tour. And your grandmother gets off the train, there's a sign there that says tour, she goes, perfect. That's just what I need, because I don't know anything about Barcelona.
And that's exposition.
That's right.
So they've exposed some stuff.
Yeah. But they've exposed some stuff, but the thing is, they're taking an environmental point of view, right? They put something in the same place that the learner is. Rather than taking the learner and putting the learner in some place where the resource is. You see the difference? It's like Second Life, right? They put the video in Second Life rather than grabbing the people out of Second Life and taking them to a movie theater. You see the difference? And the thing is, when you do it that way, now you can picture, you can actually design in your own mind what the train station looks like. Instead of a group of thugs ready to pull off each person as they come off the train, you come and there are choices. You can take a tour. You can rent a bicycle. You can get a map. You can take a walkway. There's a city bus waiting, which will go some predefined route. You see what I mean? And you have these choices. Now,
I still think it's a matter of degree, and we can get off this. We can further discuss this later. If you wish, but at some point, where do you stop coddling or not coddling? But you view it as kidnapping kids, but do you have an alternate scenario where kids could go through life without being injected into a formal education
program? Well, I mean, that is the scenario where they go through life without being injected into a formal education system, where kids are put in an environment where information and resources are available to them and they are able to choose their own direction.
As Montessori tried this, and after long studies, they realized that they should not go further than preschool, because then when they got into school, they had some acquired knowledge, a social knowledge that was higher than the other children, but they wanted to impose their way to others. So it made a conflicted situation for the teacher to have students that went to traditional preschool and Montessori. And for that reason too, the learning environment of each Montessori school was not regularized. So students have different backgrounds. So it was very difficult for the first grade teacher to try to level everyone off. First of all, the Montessori kids did not respect the class rules, because they're used that the class rules is their creative own rules. Well, you don't hit or spit, cultural rules, but putting the learning rules are created by the Montessori. So that's where I see a conflict in the same point of view.
But the question is, was the problem with the Montessori method, or was the problem with the system into which these children were eventually put?
Oh,
the problem was in leveling off
the system. But I still haven't figured out a solution that would work better than it for.
It's like too extreme. I can't imagine 8-year-old people or like children in class without structure.
Well, because you're already imagining them in a class. Why are they in a class? Why did you kidnap these kids and put them in a class? Why have you put them in this room with four walls and utterly no information resources or nothing to do or no games or toys? Or
but would you consider that humans have common needs? One of them is to learn. The other, like, is to breathe, right? So that's a common need. If we don't breathe, we don't live. But for learning, what we're trying to do, I think, with the education system is mass produce the transfer of information. If we don't do that, then everybody is on their own, like you.
Well, that doesn't follow, but we'll leave that aside.
Why doesn't it follow?
Well, because, I mean, you're drawing this contrast between mass production and nothing. Right?
But nothing. No. The thing I'm going at is mass instruction or mass similar types of information transfer as opposed to all personalized information transfer. Right? Because what you're proposing is basically individualized, chosen information transfer, which means that there's all the information that you could want.
Sure, the technical term is mass personalization.
Okay. So, you're a 3-year-old kid, you don't know how to read yet. Where are you going to learn how to read?
From your personal computer. Where else? Or it won't be a computer necessarily. Have you ever read Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age?
No.
You should read that. And in that book, the premise, or one of the plot devices is, I forget the exact name of it. The young woman's primer or something like that. Well, what it is a personalized computer application that adapts itself to the person that owns it and has as its purpose to teach that person. But of course, it's a computer; it can't actually force the person to do anything. But it develops over time a relationship with the child so that the child learns important things like how to read from the computer. And the thing is, and that said, okay, the other thing too is, because you asked like, how would they learn to read, as though they would never learn to read on their own unless we force them to. But, let me finish the sentence. That's okay. If they need to read in order to do the things that they want to do, they will learn to read. So, the idea here is that putting them in an environment where they want to do things itself leads them to want to read. As Seymour Papert says, things are fundamental only because you need them in order to do the things that you want. Okay, I'm sorry.
I agree with that.
But what happens if a person is in a social environment, it's a family environment,
mm-hmm.
that does not promote that kind of learning. And I too have my own beef about the school system, where basically it's very structured, it's very limiting. But at the other hand, it provides an opportunity to a large number of the population who would not have that kind of structure or opportunity to want to learn. Because if, I would say, as my child would have the opportunity, and my husband and I would have the skills to help the child develop the proper skills to learn on their own. Exactly, and stimulating to want to learn and to build that motivation to learn. But my neighbor might not.
It's always the neighbor. It's never.
Well,
but that's the way the story is always told, right?
Yeah, but if you take, for example, that we're all in education to a certain degree, so we all have particular interests. But take those people who didn't do well in school, have a tendency, and I'm generalizing, I don't mean to be that way, have a tendency to foster that same kind of environment for the school, where not as important, your reading is not as important, maybe because they're somewhat illiterate. No, but they're somewhat illiterate. Like, I mean, you know, based on the studies, or illiteracy is
Yeah. Anyway, I didn't
want to
attract
the attention. Oh, no, no, it's okay. Go ahead.
From here to there, and going back to the learning art center, this problematic that you would show in an ideal world, while government could sponsor learning center, but it gets to be school, and they have to get there too, so it's comes back to your situation. Yeah. I find it's a great idea, but it just doesn't fit everybody. The thing is, you know, we don't want it to fit everybody. I don't think we can imagine that. I think it's a great perspective to see it that way. And but some people do not necessarily want their kids at 2 years old to be on the computer learning, you know, learning how to read. I'm one of those. I don't necessarily want my child to learn how to read from a computer. I want to see that gradual. I like to be involved, and but I don't know. It's just.
I don't want to be involved. Somebody better teach
you how to read. Well, I mean, it's a funny thing that you say all this, because when you look at the actual amount of time that children spend actually, you know, learning, properly so-called, as opposed to, say, watching TV, playing video games, talking with their friends, gabbing on the cell phone or whatever. And it's just such a tiny percentage of their time is spent in this formal education as compared to all these other sorts of media. And, you know, if what you are saying is right, then really all of their other media should be censored and controlled as well. Yet we don't do that. Right? Mm-hmm. We don't do that. The vast majority of what they do is, to a large degree, already self-selected. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so what I am saying amounts to is, given that in a democracy, even for children, most of what people do is self-selected, then our challenge is to get learning into the things that they have selected, rather than attempting to get them into the learning. And so it's easy to criticize what I'm saying. Oh, it's so it's idealistic and all of that. It would never work that way. But the one place that doesn't seem to work is the place that we force them to do. They can all recite the lyrics to McDonald's commercials. They can all tell you all of the characters on Sesame Street. If they play Myst, they can give you a detailed description of the geography. If you got a 12-year-old boy, ask them who's leading the NHL in scoring, what's his goals and assists, how long he's been in the league. They are learning all kinds of stuff, right? But we've completely ignored that, because we think all the learning happens in the school, and we tailor all of our work to that. Instead of trying to get, hockey, it's a hotbed of mathematics.
Mm-hmm. But you agree that's not what I was saying. What I was saying is not a black and white issue, that we need to support them in some way so that they can support themselves in another way. I'm not saying, because I do believe in the fact that people learn a lot more outside of formal education than they do within. I don't disagree with that.
But I mean, but my point is saying it's not a black and white issue doesn't really add anything. I mean, it's saying, your idea is wrong, just there's another perspective here. No, it's not like that. When you say it's not a black, I'm trying to articulate this politely. Yeah, I know, but
you're in public.
But it's as though, to put it in a different context, context. It's as though I was advocating freedom. You're sitting there saying, well, yeah, but, you know, there's the people who are already slaves, and there's the people who want to be slaves, and you have to take all of that into account, too. And it's like, well, yeah, I know. But, you know, overall, freedom's still good, and isn't that where we ought to be directing our activities instead of trying to accommodate all the dictators and slaveholders and all of that? And that's how I interpret those sorts of remarks. And let's work toward the positive instead of trying to accommodate the negative.
But you want to open the door. It has to be a little bit backwards from that. It's like you have to start in the earth. Like you're saying, start at the young age so that methodology is instilled in our kids so that they develop that way of learning.
Right.
Exactly. They develop that skill because right now, I only have my 5-year-old in kindergarten, so I haven't seen the other aspects of what you're mentioning. When you presented those examples, I started thinking, true. He is going to be more influenced by television and government. I don't know if that's just yet, but they are going to be there. So if you do start by changing at an earlier age, I think this would be a great progression
to do. And the flip side of that, though, too, is like the poor kid's formal education is actually going to destroy any love of learning, independence, self-sufficiency. I'm exaggerating, of course, individuality, because the system is designed to level them out, put them in a box. So, and we understand it. We know that that's the way the system is. We know that many people today have grown up in that system and therefore are not able to cope, right? Nonetheless, when we're thinking about and talking about how we should design learning, we should approach it from the point of view of how it should work and then only later worry about the backward compatibility, right? And so much of what I see in, like in learning design is, you take this backward compatibility as established fact, and that's the place we need to begin from.
Okay, so sorry for the big interruption.
That's okay. So, and this is just another instance of the second life point that I've been making. People talk about how to bring games into learning. I want to talk about how to bring learning into games. Similarly with workflow and all of that, and the idea here is to bring the learning into the workflow process. I've often used the example, because I'm not very good at creating this at all, creating PowerPoint slides. And the reason for that is there's no way to learn how to create PowerPoint slides while you're creating PowerPoint slides. Now, there is Microsoft Help, which is characterized mostly by the fact that it doesn't. So, and like I said just a few minutes ago, like the existing systems, the developments in online learning to date has always facilitated and supported that existing way of learning where, we decide, you follow. And we should be developing systems which, again, takes as a starting point the idea that people are doing what they want to do and then can ask the question, how can we get the learning to them? And the irony is, when you're talking about backward compatibility, even if people, poor people, are stuck imprisoned in a classroom, if we have our kind of system, we can even deliver learning there, although that's one of the hardest places to actually get content to, which is, and if you don't believe me, go to a school and try to get on a blogging engine or Wikipedia or any of these sources of learning. So,
try developing a website for a school.
You're
very limited in the technology.
And so the first iteration of this mechanism that delivers learning to where people are these technologies, the blogging, the podcasting, game mods, all of these sorts of things. But the next iteration and where learning technology is and should be going is in this Web 2.0 learning network approach, where we have a task, as in the language of e-portfolio, this place where the person's learning and creation can be right at the intersection of learning, of education, of home and work, of hobbies and all of that. So, in other words, removing the learning from the learning environment and putting it into the person's other environments, their work or living environment. And I'm going to skip these because they're not relevant. Is that? Yeah. Actually, that is kind of where I want to stop. So I'm going to stop there. I don't want to get bogged down in groups and networks because it's an interesting issue, but I don't want to get bogged down in it because I don't think it'll help at this point. So that's basically what I want to say at this point. Oh, well, that was the part I just said I didn't want to get. we'll go. We can. Another way of characterizing the same sort of distinction that I've wanted to characterize is the distinction between, oh, that's kind of neat. Wasn't expecting that. Oh, because it opened in Microsoft Photo Editor, which is not what I asked for at all, but we'll leave that aside. I wonder why it did that. Anyhow, again, the factory model versus the ecology model, the existing school model versus the freedom model, if you will, the group model versus the network model. The group model is one way, like the school class, the leveling out, versus the network model, the many ways, many points of view, many lifestyles, etc. And if you think about the different sorts of technologies that characterize this, on the group model, there's one message. That's what you get on TV, radio, books, newspapers. There's one message which is then distributed to the masses. Whereas with the network model, there are many messages. And so the technology, for example, talking is a network technology. Using the telephone is a network technology. Personal emails is a network technology. Many messages, many sources connected in a network. And by way of analogy, again, there's many different analogies. Think of the metallic or elemental analogy, and this is actually a very good analogy for a number of reasons, but the metallic elemental analogy, if you think like a rod of gold, for example, and what makes it a rod of gold is all the atoms are the same. And so the important thing is, you know, how many gold atoms there are, how pure the rod is, making those, and that's the model here. As compared to, and we talked about this earlier, the organic or the biological model. The other, and I'm showing my Canadian heritage here, I don't know if they still teach that in schools. I think they should if they don't. The difference between the melting pot, where everybody may start out different, but they're all put in the pot and they all come out the same, as compared to the solid bowl picture of society where everybody is different and you get the whole out of that distinctiveness. Do they still teach that? Does anyone know? That's worth checking. Because I think they should, personally, with that kind of side. And so we look into the characteristics, and I've come up with four characteristics of successful networks, and these are characteristics that I use, first of all, as a mechanism for selecting which technology I think will be successful or not successful, and secondly, as a set of design parameters, the overall design parameters. So, successful networks foster diversity. They allow individuals to be individual. They allow people to be different. They encourage difference. They encourage individual creation. They encourage customization, personalization, anything that allows things to be different. They promote autonomy. They're things that allow people to make their own decisions for themselves. They promote openness. That is to say, they allow connections between different systems. They
how do I want to put that? And I always struggle with openness, because openness is the capacity of anybody to contribute and of anybody to retrieve information. And when you hash this out in different ways, it comes out differently. When you hash this out technologically, openness means supporting both Windows and Macintosh and Linux, for example. Openness means allowing networks of all types to interoperate, to create an inter-network, that sort of thing. But openness also means, you know, in society also means, you know, the allowing of all people to be part of society, to take part in society, allowing all people to gather benefits from society.
Not for profit.
Pardon?
Not for profit. When you think of it, like, when you think of it in that context, it's accessible to everyone. So
yes.
Not for profit, and the other one would be closed for, I noticed that membership is not for profit.
Yeah, certainly, absolutely. When I say something like everybody should be able to get from the system, that means that things like barriers, subscription walls, logins, all that sort of thing that creates that membership sort of thing, those work against openness and so work against successfully functioning networks. And then the last thing is connective. The entities, the individuals in the network need to be able to communicate with each other. I need to be able to send the signal, and you need to be able to receive that signal. And ideally, more or less, the same signal that I sent. As compared to systems that promote unity, everything needs to be the same. I've said this several times. The person who came up with the idea of the vision statement should be thrown out a window. think about it. Even think about this group here, right? You all work in the same enterprise, but I'll bet you dollars to donuts, if I ask each of you individually in separate rooms where you're not performing for the rest of the group why you are doing the job that you're doing, I'll get 14 different answers. Mm-hmm. Right? Because that's reality. And so the whole idea that there would be some vision statement that guides everybody's participation in the project is silly. Right? We need to understand that people do come from different perspectives and that they do have different motivations. And then the question becomes, how can all of those different motivations work together given our diverse interests? Coordination. The old way requires leaders. It requires collaboration, properly so-called, where I say, you do, that sort of thing. It requires subservience to the group value, which is typically the leader's value. The old way, closed systems, membership, in camera, standards and jargons and things that define us versus them. And I include this copyright and patents and things like that. When I did this, I drew this diagram in New Zealand. I was still very much under the influence of my experience in South Africa. And my experience in South Africa was that it's a society of walls. Everywhere I went in South Africa, I saw walls. Walls or fences, even now, it's just like walls everywhere. And my thinking is like, well, my thinking was it's a marathon, they're still surviving, but you know, but my main thinking was you can't build a society with walls. You just can't. And then I went to New Zealand and there was this group dynamics thing happening and I saw the same sort of thing. I saw walls. They're not actual physical walls, but virtual walls. And so the same sort of, you know, in the group, out of the group. You're with us or you're against us, all of that sort of thing. So, you know, walls and bridges is the metaphor that I was thinking of when I actually came up with this diagram in the first place. And you can't build a society out of walls, but you can build a society out of bridges. The important thing in our society isn't the walls that separate us, it's the roads and the sidewalks and the telephone lines and all of that bring us together. And then finally, the last thing that characterizes the old system is the distributive rather than the connective method of information distribution. By distributive, what I mean is there's one source and then it's broadcast or distributed to everybody else. There's a centralized power
It's a system based on stars and gurus. One person knows, everyone else listens. It's a system that is based where we're on authority, where knowledge, like money, flows from authority. As compared to the network where it's based on conversation, where knowledge and money and authority are distributed. It's a system based more on democracy than dictatorship. It's a system where knowledge emerges from the network as a whole rather than being created by some specialist or authority. So these are the characteristics that in my mind ought to inform the design of learning technology. And I have, you know, the thing that I showed you earlier and all of that. But these are the principles that I'm holding in my head. But I'm trying to build one of these and not one of these. And so at every point, almost every point of the design, we come in from one of these arguments. Should it be one of these? Should it be copyrighted? And all of these are the different points of contention. I'm sorry.
So you said remember the learning art school you worked on for a year with your father, and I just had a flash of it. I was living in a third world country, and the government had money to pay for the teachers because they would give the job to politically inclined teachers that supported them,
right.
So they were bottle jobs. But there are some of the teachers that were hired that were honest to the cause. So the desire to create a learning center for the art, for art. So they have theater, music, and fine arts, and dance. So what they did, they took an abandoned building that no one wanted because it's close to a refinery, so it's safe. So they just went there, the teacher, and posted in the local newspaper that they wanted to create an art learning center, so the only thing they had is teachers. So they invited the community to participate. And finally, the school has been going on now for maybe 12 years, and there's no, the teachers that are hired by the government, really what they do administer, trying to get funds, clean up the school, install a toilet at work, and the community is teaching art, and there's no schedule, there's just learning areas. There's a learning area of music, there's a learning area, and Michel Camilo was one of the initiators that pushed on this, I think, piano study in the Uruguay Communist Republic. It was his vision that was translated through the school. And the school works, they don't have any budget, they don't have any inscription, there's no physical identification of students, but there is a big community there. So they did bring the learning to the ones, and most of them that are there, sometimes go there and they don't even have food. So people go there with pretty much that.
Yeah. And the worst thing you could do with something like that is try to organize it and manage it, because that would break it. And ironically, that's the first thing that would happen if it started getting funding, because then it would have to be accountable, quote unquote.
Well, I hate that word.
Me too. And I don't mind accountability. I don't mind saying what I've done.
If people understand what it
means. But where I begin to worry about accountability is where accountability becomes management. And people try to say, okay, you need to do such and such. Because that, it breaks it. It actually does break it.
And some of the students that went out of this, I mean, three of them, that one of them, his artist, he would draw anything he would see, and now he's in Germany as a professional artist, and he lives very well. And some of them are part of that and the society and got more learning on their own, and
making a living out of it. Right. And there's a few other musicians that now are in the state of working professionally that came out of the school. They promoted a lot, you know.
You see, and I would, and the sort of picture that I would have is you'd have this living arts center, and you'd have this living industrial fabrication center. Because some people like welding and carpentry and plastics extrusion. My brother loved, he was working, he loved plastics extrusion. Me? You can't see it. But, and you'd have the sports center for people. I mean, you already do. Many societies have sports centers. And, you know, and again, and you'd have, you know, the writing or, you know, the reading and writing and et cetera. It's, you know, and why not? Why couldn't that?
Stephen, I feel really bad that we started this meeting without acknowledging the people at a distance and saying good morning to them and inviting them to at least get over to the room. And I feel really bad for them. I'm still wondering if they're there. I mean, if they don't even exist. Can we offer them a chance to ask a question? Claude, Rachel, Justine, do you guys want to start or finish this question period? I don't know where we're at now.
I'm just going to check if everything's working. J'avais donné accès, il était censé l'avoir. Hein. Oh, on n'a pas eu accès. Ok.
I wanted to ask questions. I wanted to ask questions for about half an hour. Stephen, I have a question regarding modernization. Your vision of education. Right now, we have a lot of feedback here. Can you shut down your microphone that you're in while I'm talking?
Where is the microphone?
Thank you very much. Okay, well, my question is regarding democratization. Okay, it's well and good. Okay, you go to the art center and you you learn. Well, I lived in New Brunswick for years. I've seen all the different communities. And they're not equipped at all to handle that kind of stuff. And you have all the educators. You have to teach. Well, you have to teach them how to do that. So, how can you implement such a formula outside of the main cities such as Moncton?
Well, how do I want to put this? Yeah, because I grew up in a small town, definitely outside the main city. It had a population of 500. And it did a lot of this sort of stuff that I'm describing. Maybe I was influenced by my upbringing, although I didn't really like that small town. Never mind. But, I mean, you know, every year in October there would be the Metcalf Fair, and you know, and then there was the curling club and the hockey rink that burned down and was rebuilt by the community. You know, there was the town library and things like that. A lot of these things can be done on a very small scale. You don't need a city of 100,000 people, you know, to have, you know, an arts and crafts area or something like that. So that'd be the first part of the answer. The second part of the answer is, and this may sound cynical, but I don't see why. You know, but they can drive. So, I mean, it's not like they're completely isolated from each other. I mean, when I lived in northern Alberta, I lived half an hour from the nearest town. And nonetheless, I mean, we still communicated with each other. We still did things together. So, I mean, you know, transportation is possible. And then finally, I mean, one of the big advantages of the internet is that it allows people to form these kind of affinities on a virtual basis, where you know they don't actually need to be in the same place. I remember, it was years ago, someone called, who was it? Claire, it wasn't Claire Martin, it was Claire somebody from Western Australia, talking about this man in one of the communities that her education district served, that was very isolated, but who was interested in knitting, and was able to connect with all the people who were interested in knitting online. And I think if you look online, you look at places like Yahoo Groups or Google Groups or whatever, and you see community after community after community that are virtual instantiations of this concept of the Living Arts Center. And it's fascinating because I look at these communities and I see utterly no effort, or virtually no effort, certainly no official effort on the part of educational institutions to support them or get resources to them or help them in any way. And yet they still exist and they still thrive. So, you know, I don't think that living in a small community makes something like the Living Arts Center impossible. I think that the scale differs, obviously. I think that the mechanics differ, obviously. The other aspect of the question, a sort of implicit aspect, is there are no resources for this sort of thing. And I contend that there are resources for this sort of thing, certainly even in this province. And I think that, to a large degree, it does come down to a question of priorities and where your priorities are. In the time that I've lived in this province, we've blown $800 million on our emulsion. Irving got, how much was the tax break in St. John for Irving? Again, hundreds of millions of dollars. The money is there. I mean, that money itself would have done the job, but it was spent elsewhere. And so, I mean, the community can afford it, but it means that in some cases, the management and priorities of the community need to be changed. And I'll say that. I'll say that straight out, you know. So that would be my response, I guess.
Okay, I had thanks for your response, Stephen. I have a second question. It's regarding resistance to change. There's a debate, well, I live in Quebec City right now, and there's a huge debate right now on educational reform, K-12, regarding, well, what should we do with social constructivism, which is the new curriculum in Quebec. And teachers won't follow for many reasons. So you have a lot of resistance. So if we were to implement solutions such as those you've introduced us to this morning, how would we cut the resistance from the teachers, from different stakeholders, from the people who know and say, well, if we don't add grades, it's no good, etc., etc. There's this big problem of resistance to change in our society.
I've been asked how these sorts of things will come to be developed in the school system, and my typical response has been they won't be. And even at this moment, I don't think that new forms of education will develop inside educational institutions. Even this one here, despite this group, I can just imagine this group, the difficulties it faces on a day-to-day basis, with just the sorts of things that you talked about. I think that what we are seeing now is the gradual emergence of an alternative and parallel system of learning that is non-institution based, and that is gradually eroding the importance or the relevance of the institution. And I think this is a good thing. And I think it's a good thing because insofar as there's resistance to change, the response should not be to try to stamp out the resistance, because that's what dictators do. the response should be to let them do their own thing and to root around it. I mean, there are ways of introducing, you know, the Web 2.0 type ideas without having to bring the teachers along. Now, I think personally, I think, you know, the smart teachers will follow along, but I still think, you know, some very smart people will still disagree, and that's okay. But, you know, I mean, if the attitude is to make the resources available, if the attitude is to create the mechanisms through which individual students can build their own learning communities, their own learning networks, then it doesn't matter if all the teachers aren't cooperating. It's just not as relevant. So I think that's the attitude I would take. It's when you try to force everybody to adopt the new way that you run into these sorts of problems. But I just, you can't force people. You know, it's always true. It's true in technology, and I think it's true in social systems. And so any change that requires forcing people to do something, I think, is going to be broken in some way. I think that's the best answer I can give to that. Hello on the text. Maybe she doesn't have voice.
Justin,
yeah, she doesn't have access.
Oh, no,
I'm not saying. You can type your question if you have any special ones.
I love it, Anto. Yeah? T'es censé l'avoir, Justin? Oui, module, celui-ci. Ça, ce petit crochet-là lui donne accès à parler quand t'as vu. Il faut qu'elle l'active de son côté. Oui. Si tu peux pas.
Justin, ça ne semble pas être activé de son côté. Et l'option pour aller écrire ta question.
Elle a déjà fait auparavant, on a fait des tests cette semaine, je sais que ça fonctionnait, puis elle était capable de faire, il n'y a pas de problème.
She doesn't have any questions.
Yeah.
And she didn't hear very well.
Oh, that's too bad. Same bad. Oh. You know, I think that over time, the mechanism of learning and the mechanism of evaluation will be separated.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'll happen very suddenly. After years of gradual development, it'll be like one of these overnight successes, right? You know, after 20 years in the music industry, he became an overnight success. It'll be like that, and because, I mean, we're already seeing that now. There are all kinds of certifications that are independent of the manner in which you study for them. I talked to the CGA people in Toronto about a week and a half ago, and they were going in the other direction, which was, I thought, was kind of interesting, and I you know, it's like they were being pulled by the universities to tie the learning mechanism to the CGA designation. And I questioned them on that, and they sort of began to think about that. Maybe it doesn't really matter how somebody learned it, as long as, you know, we can show whether or not they actually have acquired that designation. And so now we get into situations where the question becomes not how they learned, we don't care how they learned. The question becomes, how do we know that they are, you know, properly able to do what they do? And, the question you raise, like in health and things like that, you want to know that before they do what they do rather than after.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Right. As long as you pass the exam. Exactly.
I have a buddy in engineering school who never showed up at his farm. He worked at night.
Mm-hmm.
And he finished with a 31 something. Never saw him.
In my final year of classes, I decided, because I was spending so much time at the student newspaper, in my final fourth year, I said, look, I got to start going to class. And I actually made myself a little chart with a little X every time I had a class that I successfully attended. And after the whole year of diligently marching down these classes, I actually made it to 2/3 of my classes. And I was very pleased, because I was a dramatic improvement in attendance. People can, in fact, succeed in learning without going to class. We know this.
And we do know that the education system, the more stuff you add to it, the less return you get out of it. It's true for any formal organization. For the overhead of running the operation.
Yeah.
Like I was saying the other day about my organization, is this team, can you press pause?
I can, but I don't want to.
It costs us more now to get approval of what we do than it costs us to do what we do.
Yeah. That's okay. I mean, this is nothing we haven't said to our management anyway. So.
That's right.
And the other thing too is it's nothing that's unique to our organization.
No.
But it, as the organization grows, as opposed to, because it is a group and you have one person in the head, as opposed to a network where you can have collaborative decision-making processes, it's the end result that is clearly evident.
And the proof is in the application. When we ran the e-learning group, when we had an e-learning group, very much in a network fashion for a number of years, and with very good results. In general, the network organization is going to work better than the managed group organization. And the same sort of thing is going to be true with the management of learning. You have to be ready for this picture that is going to emerge. Sooner or later, we're going to have a government that will do it. And they'll do it because access to learning will be so widespread through things like OpenCourseWare and Open Universities and all of these sorts of opportunities online, that the public is going to be saying, why are we spending billions of dollars every year on country clubs for rich kids? Because to a large degree, that will be the distinguishing feature between university and non-university. Right? It's not the learning. You can get the learning anywhere. And this will become more and more evident. We're already seeing this in universities' marketing campaigns and advertising for themselves. They're not advertising the quality of their professors or how good their math program is. They're advertising that they have wireless in the dorms, that they have good school teams, the best parties in the state, and all of that. So that's what they're advertising.
Republican.
And the irony is that it'll probably be from the conservative side of the spectrum that will say, we've got to stop funding these things. I think that's a bit ironic, because they're the primary beneficiaries, but that's an aside that probably shouldn't have been recorded. But nonetheless, there will come a point when somebody in a position of power realizes, hey, if we had some mechanism for testing people, we wouldn't need to pay for the university system because people could teach themselves. Right? And now, how do you get a mechanism for testing people? This is where the right-wing politicians come in. You privatize it. Now, you might think this is a horrible disaster, but when it happens, and it will happen, it will be seen widely among both left and right as a good thing, because it will open up the capacity for all people, and not just rich people, to get recognition for their learning. So when it is seriously suggested, and it will be seriously suggested, there will be very little resistance. So it'll pass very quickly. That's why I say, 20 years in the making, but it'll be an overnight crisis for universities, because as soon as universities lose that capacity to be the only agency that tests, then what have they got? The learning? I mean, let's be serious here. They're country clubs for rich kids. Less so in the public universities, I'd say, St. FX or these places that very much are designed to turn rich kids into prime ministers. But, But I mean, it's an awful lot for society to pay billions of dollars a year so that frat kids can have keg parties. You can just see the lines of argument that are going to come out, right? As soon as you hear that kind of argument, you realize if that line of argument becomes believable, then the end is months away, not years away. So, from the perspective of educators, now the question becomes, what can you do when your primary source of funding has evaporated, your public support has evaporated, and the only way you're actually going to get any sort of customers at all is to actually teach them stuff. And now you're in a completely different situation. Now you can't force them to sit in the classroom. Right? Now you can't require them to participate in the discussion, or they'll lose 10 points on their grade, because that's not how it works anymore. You might say, well, how can the tests and that actually establish that people know what they know? But mostly that's what we do now. And actually, once we privatize the testing system, and I hate to say privatize because I really don't believe in privatization, but once that happens, then a much wider array of mechanisms will be brought to bear, because the actual price per test can go up, because we're not subsidizing this large learning infrastructure anymore. And so people will be able to prove that they're medically competent as doctors or nurses or whatever by working in simulations. That's how we test airline pilots now, and generally with good results. If you think about it, every single airline pilot has flown a plane full of passengers for the first time. And in fact, the last flight you were on might have been that pilot's first flight with passengers. And yet, they haven't lost one. Not one. That's a pretty good track record, right? That shows what simulations can do. In fact, they haven't even lost any of these practices. Because you have an airline pilot, you fly a 747, you at least have them fly an empty one once. haven't lost any of those either. Right? It's never happened. So the system works. And so it simply becomes a question of how good the simulations will be, how good the evaluation procedures will be, which is why people will want it privatized so that different evaluation services can prove themselves in the marketplace. And that'll be the argument. And that argument will be successful. Because again, it becomes very difficult. The only argument against it is the cost of offering this testing service. But now you're into almost a Medicare kind of scenario, where if a person takes the test at this service, they can be subsidized for it by the government or whatever. So, and there's your public funding of education. So you make the resources and the mechanisms for distributing the resources available on the one side, so that everybody has access to the learning. And then you make access to the testing accessible. You have a completely accessible system, and it's costing you a tenth of what it costs you now. The only problem is you've just made every professor in the country unemployed. So something like this will evolve.
And that's my objection throughout your whole approach or model. I'm always thinking, how does this work in a capitalist model like we have? Like, how is it economically viable? If no one is paid to teach, who's going to pay? Who's going to learn, or who's going to put the content online? And if you can't put the great minds together, the great minds that are working on things that are not sellable, like finding where the universe comes from, and fundamental question, if you don't have that kind of an area, how does learning occur?
Sure.
And how do you bring people that don't have the initial spark to learning? How do you raise a whole community ground level of understanding or of learning or of fluency in language and arts and mathematics? How do you bring your whole population up to be socioeconomically viable? That's my whole question. I listen to you all the time in sense, but I'm always wondering, like, how do you make this work in the real world?
Okay, well, let's think about what we, if accept the scenario that I've just given, and think about what we've done with that, okay? We have now made post-secondary education available to every person in the country at 10% of the cost that we're spending now, okay? So now we've got 90% of this money to work with, all this money that we used to be spending on universities, which we're not anymore. We have a whole bunch of professors, some good, some bad, some indifferent, who are now mostly unemployed. And, the whole range of possibilities opens up. The model that I've talked about from time to time involves the idea that part of doing any profession is to be a teacher in that profession. So, if you're an airline pilot, part of being an airline pilot is to teach people how to be an airline pilot. Now, of course, we think, well, how can airline pilots take the time to go into a class? But, of course, they're not doing that anymore. So what is it for an airline pilot to teach being an airline pilot while at the same time being an airline pilot? And the answer is, in my mind, very simply, is doing this job openly, right? So that the pilot does the job of being a pilot, and anybody who's interested in being an airline pilot can follow along as the airline pilot pilots the aircraft. It's like that Channel 9 service on the airlines in the United States. I just love that service. We don't have it here because it's Air Canada. They don't want you to know. And what it is Channel 9... you have the music, rock music, jazz, blues, classical, because it's I don't know why. And one of the channels is you get to listen in on the cockpit radio. And you hear all of the interactions. That's the only thing I listen to when I fly in the States, is Channel 9. It's the only thing I want to hear. Because I can hear music anywhere, but this is the only place I get to listen to the actual real-time, real-life conversations in a cockpit in an airplane. Talk about learning. I've learned more from that than I've learned in all the reading I've ever done about airplanes. I've read lots about it. Now imagine, instead of just channel 9, I'm in my seat, or I'm in my home, or wherever, and I can see, I can not only hear the conversation, I have various, you know, video camera views of the cockpit, so I can see the controls, I can see the captain, I can see at the front, I can see at the back, whatever. Imagine that the captain and the other people, the navigator, the